couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Downton Abbey, Rambo Last Blood, essentially the same movie as Downton Abbey, Ad Astra, I Am Mother, and the Netflix series The Spy. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring John Carpenter's Vampires. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news I wanted to hit is about, everything's about remakes, quite literally, is what's going on in the news segment here. But the one remake I want to talk about isn't a remake. It's a reboot of a franchise. After the Wolfman did not restart the Universal Monster movies, and then after Dracula Untold didn't restart the monster movie franchise, and then after The Mummy with Tom Cruise failed to restart the monster movie franchise, they're finally trying again. You know, they've got this Invisible Man movie coming out, but you do have a new Universal Monster franchise attempt in the works, and it's going to be a disaster, I'm just telling you right now, because they've tapped Paul Feig to direct a movie called, at this point, the working title is Dark Army. And there's no details about this. I think this shows exactly what's wrong with franchise attempts. And what I find hilarious is they're looping back to what fails franchises in the first place, 20 years ago. No one is learning from Marvel. Everyone wants the Avengers. And essentially, Universal wants the Avengers, but they want them to be the monsters. But they're not looking at what Marvel did. The first thing Marvel did is they put together four or five movies that were good on their own, that did well and had connective tissue and felt like they could exist in the same universe. And they also started out small enough so they weren't blowing up the entire planet. For example, Iron Man, the first one took place in a limited area. The Thor movie took place in just that New Mexican desert town. I mean, it took place in Asgard too, but in terms of its impact on Earth. And Incredible Hulk took place pretty much just in Harlem, the big battle at that point. And Iron Man 2 was, you know, it had a little bit in Monte Carlo, but all that took place at this World's Fair that they were doing. And the Captain America movie took place in the past. So they had connective tissue, but they never ran into each other. But they all worked within that universe, and then they tied them together with the Avengers. And that's what gave that the crossover potential. But this was not something that Marvel did and said, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to drop Iron Man in 2008 and then suddenly drop Avengers in 2009. They waited 4 years and untangled their own properties from different production studios. Everyone's trying to jumpstart. They were putting the cart either before the horse or right next to the horse. You don't need that. First of all, you just need to do remakes of the monster movies and do them decently. The Wolfman movie was terrible. And the Dracula movie didn't really feel like a Dracula movie. Start making it work, but don't overblow it. And then the other thing they do is, in the past, when they would do these remakes, especially in the 80s and 90s, especially the 90s, they would hand it off to a director, and that director would put his fingerprints all over it and change it and do whatever he wanted to, and basically make it associated with the original source material that you couldn't connect it to something else. The same thing happened when Zack Snyder did Superman. When Man of Steel came out, that thing wasn't connected to any other movie, and he had changed the mythology and it just unnecessarily. So Universal's basically doing the same thing. They're talking about saying, we're going to make this individual movies based on artists' interpretation of them, which is basically saying any crazy director can step in and do whatever the heck they want to, no matter what the original source material was. And now they've got Paul Feig doing it. And look, Paul Feig is best known as a comedic director. I mean, yeah, A Simple Favor was not necessarily a comedy. It was a more dramatic movie than, say, something like Bridesmaids. But, I mean, look at the disaster he did with the Ghostbusters movie. This is not the guy that's going to relaunch the Universal Monster movie. And even those Universal Monster movies, if you look at them, they didn't start getting a little bit silly until, like, after Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. And they got well into the 40s and then did, like, the Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. That got a little absurd. But the original monster movies, you know, Frankenstein, the Mummy, Dracula, Wolfman, and you know, even stuff like the Creature from the Black Lagoon, the original one, which was in the 50s, which sort of adjacent to the Universal Monsters, they were movies that could cross over and that was cool when they crossed over. And they're starting off with like everyone in the movie. It sounds like Dark Army. They're going to have all these monsters. Again, just start with something simple and build your franchise. You don't need it out of the gate. This is going to be a disaster. And then the other big remake rumors, everyone's talking about whether or not they're going to remake The Princess Bride. Even the people involved in The Princess Bride were like, this is a terrible idea. Again, this is one of those few perfect movies of its time. I do not know how you can improve on The Princess Bride. Sure, could you use modern special effects? Yes. But most of the cast members of like the notable cameos were of a certain time. You know, they were the Billy Crystal era. It'd be like trying to remake Blazing Saddles or High Anxiety, a Mel Brooks movie that was fully Mel Brooks's group of people. The Princess Bride, a remake of that is going to be a disaster. There's no way to improve on it. It'd be like remaking Psycho. Oh, yeah, they did do that once, didn't they? Idiots. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Let's hit two movies. They're kind of different. The first one is Dark Waters, which opens on November 22nd.
How many did you lose?
190.
190 cows.
You tell me nothing's wrong here. That's chemicals, I'm telling you.
I'm seeing documents. I don't understand.
They're hiding something.
That chemical.
What if you drank it?
Drank it? That's like saying, what if I swallowed a tire?
What if whatever's killing those cows is in the drinking water?
This is obviously pushing for the awards race. It's directed by Todd Haynes, who I believe he did Carol. He showed it again in Cincinnati. It takes place in Cincinnati. I actually know people who are involved in this production. And it's a true story, but they're tagging it with the people who brought you The Post. Of course, that was a big push for an Oscar a couple of years ago, Steven Spielberg directing, you know, about the Pentagon Papers. This one is about the DuPont pollution issue. And the reality is this is a microcosm of stuff that happens all over. We saw this with Aaron Brockovich. That was another movie that showed that if you have enough money, you can hide things. And it's always a follow the money kind of movie. I'm curious to see it. I think Mark Ruffalo is going to be doing some acting outside of what he's used to. Certainly not. He's not playing the Incredible Hulk, and he's working to not be always associated with the Hulk. And a lot of these, it just all depends on the pacing and the, I mean, I thought Carol was a decent enough movie. The problem is, I don't know if you could use the same pacing. I just hope it doesn't bog down, that it holds it together as a story and as a movie. The next one I want to talk about is Like a Boss, which opens on January 10th.
We've opened up our own store. We're winning.
We're $493,000 in debt. Walk into
the room. Now pay to Mia Carter.
I'm Clara Luna.
I am going to invest $1.7 million on you.
We would love $1 million.
But in my experience, business and friendship don't always mix.
You don't have to worry. You're a pretty little head.
My head is not little. It's just that my breasts are humongous.
If you want to be a businesswoman, you're going to have to act like a boss.
As you can tell, whenever you have an award push for a movie, you're going to have a movie that's going to be probably total garbage coming out in January. They're all within like 6 weeks of each other because that's how the release schedule works. Like a Boss takes Tiffany Haddish and Rose Byrne to kind of put them together. And I think this will work better than the one she did was at Night School with Kevin Hart, because Kevin Hart and Tiffany Haddish have the same style and they clashed really. And they didn't support each other. And Rose Byrne's a very good support. Actually, she's a brilliant supportive comedian, but also funny in her own right. I mean, they're kind of channeling kind of a Laverne and Shirley feel to it, which works. And there's a reason that show was on for so long, because they had good chemistry. These two look like they have some decent chemistry. It just all comes down to the writing and the fact that it has a January 10th release date, and it kind of makes me scared. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Rambo, Last Blood, and Ad Astra. welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with a big explosive one, and that is Rambo Last Blood. John Rambo finds himself facing a band of ruthless human traffickers after traveling to Mexico to free a friend's kidnapped daughter.
All these years I've kept my secrets. But the time has come to face my past. And if it comes looking for me, they will welcome death. I want them to know that death is coming.
What's funny about the John Rambo movies is I was too young to see First Blood when it came in the theaters, and I remember a bunch of my friends saw it on either HBO or on VHS way early in the days, and it was like a huge deal. I was in about fifth grade when everybody was watching it, and everybody just thought it was fantastic. What's funny about it is my mom never let me see the movie because she thought it was too violent. And she thought it was just indiscriminate killing. And later, when I was in high school, I ended up watching the movie, like in the late 80s. And I remember telling her, I'm like, well, yeah, it's a violent movie, but it's not like nihilistic. It's got a lot to say. It's about the Vietnam War and the loss of the American soldier and guilt and surviving and all this stuff of, that lost soldier generation after Vietnam. There's a lot that movie had to say. But then Rambo First Blood Part 2 came out. And again, she was like, that's just indiscriminate killing. It's overly violent. Wouldn't let me see it. And by the time Rambo 3 came out, I don't remember Rambo 3 really making much of a splash. But I eventually saw all the movies. And it was just funny because they're violent movies. Yes, they are. And there's a lot of gun explosions and battles and that type of action in the film. But they actually have been somewhat poignant. I mean, yeah, bloody and violent, but poignant at times because the character of John Rambo is just, he's just a guy trying to do the right thing. He's just trying to survive and be good. And when he gets crossed, especially in a violent way, somebody kidnaps someone close to him or harms him or he sees a great injustice being done, he reacts. So there's a lot of heart and character to these movies, even though they're known as these tough guy explosive films. And of course, when the movie Rambo came out in, 2008, it was like 11 years ago, even more, because I think it was like a January movie. That movie was explosive, but it was also had a lot of heart to it. And there's something that Sylvester Stallone often brings to the movies. And you get the same thing with this one, where the character of John Rambo, he finally found his way home and he's trying to just live a very quiet life and keep, as he says at one point in the film, he just wants to keep a lid on all the darkness in him. But he's dragged back into it because, of course, it's a friend's daughter, but he treats her like a daughter because he's known her for years and she gets kidnapped by human traffickers in Mexico, which is like a thing now in movies. That's like now the plot device of going to Mexico. That movie Miss Bala was like that too. It was, again, these people went to a party and they got kidnapped by human traffickers. I don't know how often that happens. I'm sure it happens. But I mean, this really paints Mexico as the picture of you walk over the border and your attractive young teenage daughter is suddenly whisked away by gangsters. Yeah, I don't know how accurate that is. I've not been to Mexico in that situation. I've been to Cozumel on the beach. That's like my big Mexican experience. So this one is very much like the other ones where Stallone knows that character. And it's like he does in the Rocky movies. He knows the character very, very well. And he's the one who plays it. He's the only one who's ever played that character. Now, are they going to reboot First Blood at some point after Stallone passes? Who knows? They might. And they're trying to reboot everything. With a new person playing him, I think you could do that. I think it would be, that's one remake or reboot I could get behind. But I think Stallone fully understands the character. And this one, he's an old man, of course, but he's still John Rambo. He still has a lot of expertise. but he's not like living in the jungle like he was in the last one. He kind of is domesticated, but he's pulled back into it. My problems with the film, first of all, it's overly grisly to get to the situation. I mean, Rambo has to go out for revenge, so it has to get very dark and unpleasant for the people he loves. And that needs to happen to push the character to that point, but it's unpleasant. I don't like watching that stuff unfold in films. So they handle it as best as they can, but still, it's unpleasant to watch. As opposed to like First Blood, where it's just like, this guy's trapped. The other thing with this one is Rambo goes into some situations very foolishly. I mean, it's one thing for his teenage, what he considers adopted daughter, to go and do something stupid and foolish and naive. It's another thing for John Rambo to foolishly go into a situation that he knows he's outgunned in, or at least should realize that. So I felt that they did the beatdowns a little too much in this to finally get to the real kicker winner of, you want to see Stallone being that giant beef mountain of a guy just punching people in the face and ripping out their throats and that sort of thing. And when it gets to the point of the big action, that's cool. And you're pent up to want to see that. And it works. It absolutely does work. It does feel a little less like a Rambo movie because it takes place in it doesn't take place in the jungle. It doesn't take place in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it takes place in Mexico, but it's just this crappy little town and on his ranch back in America. But still, for that visceral reaction, R-rated violent movie that doesn't have too much CGI blood splattering at the screen, I'm going to have to say that Rambo Last Blood kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Ad Astra. Brad Pitt plays an astronaut who travels to the farthest reaches of the solar system to find his father.
What is happening out there is a crisis of unknown magnitude.
We believe your father may be involved.
My father's dead.
What exactly are you requiring from me?
Exploration isn't always a noble venture. We have to hold out the possibility that your father may be hiding from us.
Ever since Stanley Kubrick made 2001 A Space Odyssey, it seems like every movie that's trying to be serious about space has been trying to be like 2001. And we finally have a new benchmark, because Interstellar, I think, is the one that all these filmmakers are trying to live up to. I did not think Interstellar was that great of a movie. I thought it was pretentious and overlong. I thought it looked cool, and it had an interesting view of space and a realistic look at least certain parts of space travel. But I've noticed recently over the last couple of years is when a movie does have that travel into space element to it, they're trying to be like Interstellar. This feels like it's trying to be Interstellar. Now, I don't know if it is, because I haven't seen the movie, because they didn't screen it. That's not a good sign. Now, they screened it for some people. It's one that wasn't regionally screened. But the fact that they didn't screen it locally, that's not a good sign. That, to me, says that it might be a bit of a pretentious mess. I mean, it is Brad Pitt's pet project. So I didn't get a chance to see this one. Going straight on the trailer, it looks like it might be, overblown and stuffy and pretentious. But I'm going to try and check it out this week, and then I'll loop around next week and give you my take on Ad Astra to find out if it's Interstellar 2001 or if it's something totally different. But right now it has to get a preemptive suck because they didn't screen it.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Downton Abbey and I Am Mother. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with the stuffy British one now, and that is going to be Downton Abbey. The King and Queen of England will be visiting Downton Abbey, which sends the residents and the staff into disarray.
The King and Queen are coming to Downton.
What?
I want every surface to gleam and sparkle.
A parade and a dinner. I'm going to have to sit down.
How's it all going?
Mary's got it under control.
Hardly. I need your help, Carson.
I'll be there in the morning, my lady. Don't you worry.
I want to point out that I have never watched an episode. I haven't watched a frame of Downton Abbey. I've never turned it on. I've never swerved into it. I've never binge-watched it. I heard about it when it was becoming this phenomenon, and it was being name-checked in everything from book clubs to Iron Man 3. I know tons of people watch it, and it was extremely popular. It was never anything that crossed my desk. My mom used to watch a show called Upstairs Downstairs on the PBS station in Columbus where I grew up. And I remember I'd watch it at times with her, and it was basically, it's the same deal. It's the people who live, the idle rich that live in the manor, and then the servants downstairs who work. And in fact, the BBC tried to reboot Upstairs Downstairs right when Downton Abbey was becoming popular, because I think they wanted to have another similar property, and it never reached the status or popularity that Downton Abbey did. There's something special about Downton Abbey, and a lot of it has to do with the writing and the characters and the actors. Now, like I said, I knew nothing about this movie, and I actually wanted to go in knowing nothing to see if I can make sense of it. When I went and saw the press screening, they showed this 10-minute bit that I knew Focus Features had created and put online. You can find it on YouTube. Just search Downton Abbey recap. And it's one of the first hits. And it tells you the story of everything that went on in Downton Abbey so you can be up to speed for the film. Now, they went ahead and played that before the movie, and I'm like, ah, well, now I got all the background. And I will say, if you've not watched Downton Abbey, if you've never, or even if you've just watched an episode or two here, it wouldn't be bad for you to go back and rewatch that recap. In fact, if you've never seen it, I'd say that's essential viewing. Because while the movie itself does do a decent job of, within the context of the story, saying, well, this person was married to that person, but then they got widowed, and this person died, or this person went off to do this, and this person used to like that person, and it's just that there's a lot of it. There's a lot to take in and trying to process as the plot's going on. I mean, the basic plot is the king and queen are coming, so everyone's going crazy. But there's all these little minor conflicts, and all these characters have an arc in a certain way. And some of the little mini storylines are as mundane as, will the chairs be put out for the parade properly? Or will this dress be altered by the next day so I can wear it to a ball? It, you know, you have those kind of stories, but you also have greater arcs within the film itself. And there's multiple ones tied together. And it's sometimes it's tough to keep track of the characters if you don't know them. But overall, I mean, it's relatively easy to track. I did not feel lost in this movie at all. And there are just times when I just kind of blew off something and saying, well, that probably would have made more sense if I'd seen the show before. But it's very well done. I mean, it's more than just the stuffy British version of Keeping Up with the Kardashians, even though it's kind of what it is. This person's dating this person, only instead of making sex tapes and drinking all night, you know, they're talking about pressing tuxedos and what they should wear to dinner. So this is what Downton Abbey is. But the key to this is really the cast, and the writing's really good. It's tight writing until you get to the end. Like, I'm not, no spoilers about the plot, but it takes a while to wrap up everybody's storyline. Now, there probably is a good 15 minutes at the end of the film. Like, when the third act resolves, there's another good 10, 15 minutes of them just tying up every little story. And I can appreciate that if I were a fan, but ultimately I didn't care if they tied up a lot of those stories, because the overall arc of, you know, will they be able to survive the visit of the king and queen has been resolved. So it does overstay its welcome a little bit, but I can forgive it for the fact that it ran for, what, 7 or 8 years on TV. You know, stuff like Hugh Bonneville's character, who's the head of the Abbey, he really doesn't have much of a part to it. And even like the head butler, the old deep voiced guy who used to be the head butler and then he's kind of taking over again. You know, his arc isn't very strong, but I think they got all their arcs done in the show. They have the younger characters tend to be shouldering the burden of the plot. And that's okay. But it's charming and it's witty and it's funny. And although I wasn't knee slapping laugh out loud like some of the people in my audience were, I recognized the dry British humor. It absolutely worked. So I'm going to have to say that Downton Abbey kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about I Am Mother. First of all, this is a Netflix film, And I realize this movie came out a while ago. I've had it on my list to watch, and I put it on my list because it looked interesting. I remember when it came out. But it's just been just sort of sitting there collecting dust on my Netflix shelf. And then I got an email from a listener named Katie, and she's like, hey, I love the show. You know, have you seen I Am Mother? And she asked me about it. I'm like, well, I've been meaning to watch it anyways. So I figured this would be a good time to watch it, treat this as a recommendation. And it's a good movie to talk about, because one of the things I do like about what Netflix is doing is it's doing some higher concept stuff. It's not just doing soap operas and reality shows, which is kind of what you see on some other streamers like Hulu or something like that. But with Netflix, they have that stuff, but they have some pretty high concept things. You know, they've got series that are fantasy and science fiction and horror, and I like seeing that. So I'd like to see more of that. And I Am Mother is one of them. A sentient robot in a bunker raises a daughter after an unknown event wipes out humanity from the Earth.
Why aren't there any more children, Mother?
There used to be.
Then why did you only make one?
Mothers need time to learn. This facility was designed to give humanity a second chance. One that began with you.
Did you know there were people out there?
I'm as surprised as you.
There's a droid here.
Mother's not what you think. She's taken care of me my whole life.
You haven't seen what they've done.
First of all, this does fit into one of the categories of sci-fi movies I tend to like. And it's not a spaceship, but it feels like a spaceship. Certainly for the first two-thirds of the movie, it feels like you're on a spaceship because it's an underground bunker. It might as well be a spaceship. And I love movies about people alone on a spaceship trying to deal with things. Now, some of them are terrible, like that movie Passengers with Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence a couple of years ago. That thing was a disaster. Alien kind of falls into that category. But even something like Prometheus, that's one of the reasons I liked Prometheus, sort of the setup of Prometheus. And you can complain about all the stuff that goes on once you get to the planet. But I love that setup. 2001 is kind of the same thing. I've always had a bit of an affinity for this. This does remind me a little bit of that movie, and I forget the name of it. It escapes me, but the one with Robert Pattinson that came out earlier this year about the convicts that were put on a spaceship and sent to a black hole. This one's a little bit different because it has an entire movie that's essentially three people. There's the mother, the robot, there's the daughter, and there's a mysterious woman who shows up at one point, played by Hilary Swank. You know she's in it because you see her face on the key frame when you choose the movie to watch. But these movies are very hard to write sometimes because they have such few characters, and you have to keep the dramatic tension going. You have to have things for them to uncover. And I think they do a good job pacing things out. There's certain things that are predictable. I guessed a lot of what ends up happening in it, but that's okay. I've seen so many of these movies that kind of comes naturally to me. But I love the idea of the robot and the human interface. And while it doesn't have the same punch as it maybe could have, I mean, the ending could have been massaged. The third act has a couple problems in it, but overall, I think it's a neat movie, and it's certainly high concept enough and exciting enough to watch. And I love the fact that it doesn't look cheap. It doesn't look like it's a made for TV movie. It doesn't look like it's direct to video. This has the effects that it needs to work, and it doesn't overblow them, but it also doesn't send them out cheap either. So it feels like a cinematic movie. It's just, it goes on Netflix. And I think that that's cool. And that's one of the reasons Netflix is giving the other studios and television in general a run for its money. So I'm going to have to say I Am Mother kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Netflix series The Spy, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring John Carpenter's Vampires.
Stop it now.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the reviews. It's not a movie review, technically, and I guess this, you know, I don't know, does this belong in home cinema? That's a big question. Where does Netflix fall? Because obviously I Am Mother is a Netflix movie. Or does it fall in home cinema because Netflix is home cinema? They did not give a theatrical release to I Am Mother, but I never thought twice about including it in the theatrical releases. Because even like last week when I did Empathy Incorporated, I don't think a whole lot of people are going to go see that in the theaters. I wouldn't have considered that home cinema, even though most people who, when they go see that movie, are going to be watching it on demand. Netflix is certainly blurring the line between what would be considered first run theatrical and like home cinema, you know, not direct to video type stuff. So let's talk about The Spy, which is a limited series by Netflix. It's actually done by a French company. It's just that Netflix has distribution worldwide. Sacha Baron Cohen plays an Israeli spy who infiltrates the highest levels of the Syrian government in the 1960s.
My name is Kamel Amin Thabet.
The Sheikh is your only way in.
You can trust me with your life. I hope I can do the same. We all have secrets.
I don't want to go back.
You are saving lives, Ali. Remember that.
When I first became Kamel, it was just an act.
The anchor interest to this is the fact that it's Sacha Baron Cohen doing a dramatic role and not playing some immersive character like Borat or Bruno or Ali G. It's a true story about this Israeli spy who finds a way to not just infiltrate Syria, which was not easy to do in the 1960s, by the way, but to get into Damascus and infiltrate the government and get to the highest levels. And what's funny, after I watched the series, because it's 6 episodes long, so it's a little bit of a time investment, but it's not a huge time investment. I think 6 hour-long episodes are realistic to tell this story. And when it was over, I went back and I looked up the Wikipedia entry, because, of course, that's my history book, because I'm an idiot. But I looked up the Wikipedia entry of this guy, Ali Cohen, who he plays. And it seems like, for the most part, a lot of the beats in the story, maybe not the nuances and the exact conversations and the exact emotions and when this happened. You know, I think they made some adjustments to make him a lot more likable character than what you have to do if you're a spy. But what he accomplished and what he did and that detail that's more historical and political, that stuff seems to be relatively accurate. The series itself is a spy show. It's named The Spy, but it's a lot more John le Carré than James Bond. James Bond is big explosions, fast cars, James Bond walking in and announcing himself by name. He's the lousiest spy, by the way. James Bond doesn't fool anybody. This is more John le Carré, which is a bunch of people sitting in rooms listening to other people in rooms. That's real spy work, especially in the 60s. The real spy work was infiltrating somewhere and just being observant, maybe taking clandestine pictures, and then transmitting data to your base. That's really all it is. It's an intelligence gathering thing. And that's what this shows, but it shows it's more interesting to see how he gets in and what he does when he's there and how he uses that information. And yeah, there are times when you expect him to burst into a Borat impression, has some sort of accomplishment, and then go, great success. Yeah. But he doesn't do that, obviously. I mean, this is done with reverence, but it's a slow, deliberate pace. But because it's only 6 episodes, it doesn't drag. It doesn't like have an entire episode with him training. And then it doesn't feel like it's just stretched out to say, well, we need to fill 12 episodes, but we only got story for 6. They move pretty quickly in this, and each episode feels like you're moving farther and farther towards a goal. Unlike something like Carnival Row, which I started watching and is awful because it's just so boring and it's nothing but world building and it just kind of circles around and you really don't care what anything's about. So I'm going to have to say The Spy really works for what it is, but you got to stick with it and you can't watch it late at night because it does have a slow, deliberate pace. It's not an action movie. But it totally works. I'm going to say The Spy totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about the box office. Last week, as expected, it Chapter 2 beat everybody else. It came in at $40 million, which isn't bad. That's a smaller drop than the first movie. Now, of course, it started out with less, only $90 million. But it's less than a 60% drop, which is impressive. And then Hustlers overperformed. It made $33 million. I mean, it wasn't exactly nipping at the heels of Pennywise, but it was coming a lot closer than I think anyone expected. The Goldfinch was the one that probably made the most news because it bombed so hard with less than $3 million at the box office, which is a near record for how wide it was released. Also considering how anticipated it was and how much people are expecting it to get a goose from its performance at the film festivals. It certainly got a goose. It's just the goose was dead and it fell out of the sky. This week, of course, I think that Downton Abbey's probably going to win. It's got the most buzz. And as much as I liked it, Chapter 2, I think it's like a horror, any horror movie is going to drop off faster than, you know. Downton Abbey's also not going to have a huge opening, but it's going to have a sustained run because old people sometimes take a while to get to the theaters. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is actually, this doesn't come out until next Tuesday, but I wanted to hit this now because it was worth talking about, and I kind of wanted to get a jump on some of the Shout Factory stuff and some horror movies, because, you know, October's coming up. And that is John Carpenter's Vampires. It's the collector's edition. Horror master John Carpenter directs James Woods as a vampire hunter in the Southwest.
Have you ever seen a vampire? They're not romantic. Forget whatever you've seen in the movies. They don't turn into bats. Crosses don't work. You want to kill one? You drive a wooden stake right through his heart. Chances are we'll find the master in here somewhere.
Jack Crouch.
Jack, he's right behind us!
We were set up. He knew my name.
It's time to kill some vampires.
I remember when I saw this movie, I didn't see it in the theaters, but I remember seeing it on, well, it was probably on maybe VHS, possibly DVD, in the late 90s after it came out to home video. And I did not particularly like it. And it's near the end of Carpenter's run. I think then he does like Ghosts of Mars and he eventually does The Ward, which none of those did well. And he hasn't directed anything since The Ward. Really, Carpenter's biggest run of excellence is from like the mid 70s into the late 80s. I still count some of the stuff in the 90s, like In the Mouth of Madness, I really enjoyed, but really it's through the 80s where he had his best stuff, you know, Assault on Precinct 13, Halloween, The Thing, you've got, They Live, Prince of Darkness and Big Trouble in Little China. So you have this big run of really great movies from Carpenter that are really more cult films than anything else now. Now, Vampires, I think, was his highest grossing, certainly his highest grossing opening. I don't think his highest grossing movie, because you got to count Halloween in there, and that's kind of a classic that gets played all the time. But I will say that Vampires holds up a lot better than I thought it would. I mean, part of it is at the time, the Baldwin brothers were all getting known. You had, of course, Alec Baldwin, but William Baldwin and Stephen Baldwin had their own little cottage industry of film showing up in the 90s. But this one had Daniel Baldwin, who is usually the forgotten Baldwin. But he actually does a decent job in this. And he has a decent amount of chemistry with Cheryl Lee, who is, of course, from Twin Peaks. And she does a good job in it. Now, the guy who plays the master vampire in here is kind of garbage. But James Wood still works. And it's fascinating to watch the two of them talk about each other in interviews in the special features, because if you want to talk about people on either end of the political spectrum, it's James Woods and John Carpenter, but they both had great respect and they loved each other because they were working outside of politics. And I think that's actually, that's kind of an uplifting thing, especially with how contentious things can be now. But I gotta say, it's basically, it's a Western. It's a Western version of a vampire killer story. And it's not John Carpenter's best, and it is sort of cheesy. It has that machismo that Escape from New York had, where just a grumpy, snarling, sort of an anti-hero, really. He's his own Southwest vampire hunting version of Snake Plissken. But it's kind of a fun little movie to watch. It's very bloody. That's kind of part of the other thing, is it's before they started pushing for PG-13 horror, and John Carpenter goes completely nuts with some of the graphic violence in this. In some ways, I'm surprised it got released with an R rating in the first place. But still, it's kind of fun. It's disposable. It's quick. It's easy to watch. It's kind of dumb. But, it's like watching an old Western. It's just that there's vampires in it. But the new Blu-ray has some new interviews with Carpenter. It's got some new interviews with James Woods and some of the other actors in it, the cinematographer. There's audio commentary to it, some deleted scenes, and the original making of featurette, which is a little bit repetitive, but still a lot of fun to watch. It's got some great stuff. It's worth checking out from Shout Factory. John Carpenter's Vampires kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Other releases this week on DVD and Blu-ray include X-Men Dark Phoenix, The Velocipastor, Supergirl Season 4, Lethal Weapon, the third season, and Doctor Who, the complete David Tennant collection. And that's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Abominable. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.